Welcome to Make It Simple, where we take complicated issues and with the help of an expert, break them down into ideas we can understand, truths we can apply, and questions worth pondering. I'm your host, Matt Popovitz, and with me today is my co-host, Rachel Ryder. Now, Rachel, today is it's a different kind of episode. Do you remember in the 80s, like on 80s sitcoms, where they would have a very special episode of Webster or whatever it was, where they told you at the beginning they were going to do something very different than what people typically expect when they tune in? I feel like this is a very special episode of Make It Simple.
It is. This is a, I'm calling it a bonus episode. This just turned into something different than we expected. We didn't know where we were going to go with this. And it was, oh man, so much fun. I'm so excited to share this.
Yeah. So I like that. We'll call this a bonus episode. This is out of the norm. This is a departure from our pattern. This is different. This is special. We're having today just a conversation with Paul Walter Hauser. It's just a conversation the three of us had. We turned on Zoom. We invited him in and we just got to know him. Now, if you don't know who Paul Walter Hauser is, chances are you actually do know who he is.
Sure, right.
He is an actor and performer, and he's been in probably, I almost guarantee it, some movies that you have seen. So he starred in I, Tonya. He starred in Black Klansman. He starred in Cruella. He starred as Richard Jewell in the movie Richard Jewell. He is currently, can be found in theaters alongside Vince Vaughn in Queenpins. And he was on, the Netflix show, Cobra Kai. Cobra Kai. Yeah. He's a recurring character on Cobra Kai. He's on all the things. And so we reached out to him and said, hey, Paul, we love your work, and we know you're also a person of faith, and so we just want to hang out with you on Zoom and have a conversation about acting and celebrity. We kind of go there, and we also want to talk to you about being a person of faith in Hollywood. And so we sat down with him and had a conversation with him, and it went kind of all over the place, but it was a really good chat.
It was, you know, and it was really funny because as we were talking with him, we had told him, we want to be respectful of your time. We'll take about 20 to 30 minutes. And partway through, he was like, look, I'm having a good time. If you're having a good time, let's keep going. And what a great honor that it was like talking with a friend. I can't say it enough. It was like instant friendship with this guy. He is just so fun. And like you said, if you don't know who he is, you will. He is going places. It was so exciting.
Yeah. So we had this conversation like the day after my kids and I, we watched Cruella, and he's there alongside Emma Stone and does a really great job. And then as we're talking to him, he was in New Orleans, recovering from COVID. He's there filming something with Taron Egerton for a show that's going to come out on Apple TV Plus sometime in the spring. And so he's like, I got all the time in the world. I'm recovering from COVID. Let's hang out. And so we talked, and we had a great, great conversation about everything from acting to life in Hollywood, to being a person of faith. But really the conversation, it really goes towards what it means to live out your faith in a way that's loving towards others, authentically following after Jesus, which was a really great thing to chat about. We had a great time together.
Yeah, we kind of built this like we were going to talk about celebrity, or we weren't really sure what to expect. And this conversation really just, I left it going, man, how you treat people matters. Like no matter what you do, whether you're a celebrity or a pastor or just a person at the grocery store, like how you treat people matters. And he really believes that and he lives that. And it was just really beautiful to see somebody who isn't just Christian in name, isn't just a quote unquote Christian celebrity. He cares about people and he lives that out, and you can tell. I really hope, I want good things for him. He is my new favorite actor. I just want to see everything he's been in. I want to support him. I want him to do well. And I cannot wait for him to just continue to succeed and win awards. I want him to win all the awards.
Yeah. You know, he and I come from the same little part of Michigan. We have some mutual friends. And so I want to see him succeed, not just because he's a great actor, but because I want to see a fellow native of mid-Michigan, you know, win an Oscar or something. That's what I want to see happen. Yeah. So you've seen him in I, Tonya. You've seen him in Cruella. You've seen him in Richard Jewell. You've seen him in Queenpins, and you're going to continue to see him all over the place. This is Paul Walter Hauser, and this is our conversation with him. Let's dive right in. And I want to officially thank you and welcome you to the program, Paul. It's really great to meet you and chat with you.
Thanks for having me, man. Fellow Lutheran, I see the familiar, it looks like a War Bonds poster from the 40s. That Lutheran church thing in the background. I love that. I grew up like seeing that. I don't even really know what it evokes or tries to embody, other than it's a nice piece of visual nostalgia for me.
Yeah. So that's actually a sign from one of the churches that I served, actually. So I grew up in Michigan like you, but then I served churches in Texas and in New York City. And that's actually like an old school sign from the 1940s from the Lutheran church that I served in New York City. And they let me steal it when I left to come to Texas. So yeah.
Well played, man.
Thanks, man.
I'm friends with an actor named MC Gainey. Do you know who that is?
No.
MC Gainey's amazing. He's in everything from like Lost. He played a villain in season one of Lost. He's in Sideways, Con Air, a bunch of stuff. But he always takes a prop or some visual piece from everything he's worked on. And you're doing a similar thing, man. Always take a memento. That's smart.
Yeah. So answer me this, man. How do you get from the middle of Michigan, where I grew up and you grew up, out to Hollywood? Like those things are not close. Those are worlds and worlds apart.
There's really only a few ways to do it. I think most people do it the same way, but I mean, you can technically, there's like five ways. You can take a bus, you can take a train, you can fly, we drove cross country, or you can walk, which I don't recommend because it's going to take a long time. Yeah. Is that what you meant?
That's exactly what I meant. Thank you. I'm taking notes for my next trip. But like, you know, I grew up there, you grew up there. And my sense is like me, you grew up hanging around with your friends in Saginaw, Flint, that whole area.
Around. We don't have anything like Hollywood.
It's another planet.
But what was weird is we started to get Hollywood-y stuff because of that tax incentive that was in place for maybe 4 years. I think from like 2007 to 2011, there was like a Michigan tax incentive where they tried to get filmmakers to come there. And they did get some big movies. Like there was a Will Ferrell basketball movie, semi-pro, that came. Yep. There was a Sam Raimi Wizard of Oz sequel called Oz the Great and Powerful or something. So there were these bigger movies coming there. And what I did is I showed up to be a background extra, like an actor. What do they call it? An extra. Yeah. You've probably heard of that. And I just went to be an extra in a couple of Michigan movies. And I ended up getting cast in one of those movies. Weirdly enough, my faith would be a component of that, where the movie I first got, I did a movie called Virginia in 2009. I think it came out like 2 years later, but this movie had some big actors, Jennifer Connelly from A Beautiful Mind, Russell Crowe. I mean, like, or I'm sorry, not Russell Crowe, Ed Harris, Emma Roberts, Eric Roberts' daughter, mm-hmm. Julie Roberts' niece, like really, really pretty good sized cast. And I just showed up to be an extra, but I saw the filmmaker there, this guy named Dustin Lance Black. Have you seen the movie Milk with Sean Penn?
Yeah.
Yeah, he wrote that and won the Oscar for that. I saw him in it, and I said to him, I just go, hey, man, just want to say congrats on the Oscar. Loved Milk. Loved your speech. Congrats, man. That movie and the speech brought a tear to my eye. Just 30-second little, but it wasn't to gain anything. I was just being genuine. It was more like the excitement and giddiness of meeting someone in Hollywood in my home, state. But he goes, what's your name? And I told him, and he writes my name down and my like badge number. They gave all the extras like a little name tag with a number. Like it's so like, PG prison camp at those things. It's a sad affair to walk into. You know, your greatest hope when you try to be a background actor, your greatest hope is that they're like, we need someone who can play the tuba. And then you're like, I play the tuba. And they're like, you're in the movie. That's the only way it usually ever happens. But this guy saw something in me and gave me like the sixth biggest part in the movie. I was on set 10 days out of like, I think I had 10, 11 shoot days out of maybe 30. And I ended up like making friends for life with my co-stars, and like, I think I made like 10 grand or something. Oh. It was crazy. It changed my whole life. And in answer to your initial question, that's kind of how I got to Hollywood. I moved to LA after like a month after we filmed.
And you said that was in 2009, 2010?
Fall of 2009, yeah. And the movie, the experience was amazing. Like, everyone was kind to me. I got to bring family and friends to set all the time. It was like Entourage, where you never saw me without three of my high school buddies or my brother or somebody. You know, very like, very sort of dreamlike is the most honest depiction. But of course, the movie didn't do well. It famously did horrible. And I think we made like $5,000 in theaters. We only opened up in like less than 10 theaters, and it got buried, and it really hurt me because I was, you know, this guy just won an Oscar for the last movie he wrote. Now he's writing, directing a movie I'm in, and I got Jennifer Connelly and Ed Harris. I'm thinking, whoa, this is going to be a big Oscar movie. And so it was a good lesson for me to kind of, you know, I should have just been grateful and just kind of enjoyed it. And instead I kind of bloviated it into something it wasn't. And you know, I would learn that lesson again on Richard Jewell, the movie I did with Clint Eastwood, where I was just enjoying the ride. I just enjoyed it and was like really humbly grateful and quiet and chill. And then people kind of get in your ear and they start telling you things you want to hear, even when you don't ask for them. And it changes perspective. You know, my buddy Abby Davis is a Christian and works in entertainment. She's a producer. We have a line we say to each other where, you know, because she and I have a whole thing where, you know, we used to go to church together and then, you know, hit her vape pen and go get lunch and see a movie in Los Angeles. We called it Sunday Funday. So she and I on our Sunday Fundays, we'd always be saying like, why are we so ambitious and like sick in the head with wanting to be prominent and be recognized? Why can't we just enjoy the free shrimp? Because like you go to a party and it's like, why aren't you just walking in going, wow, I'm eating shrimp and drinking a cocktail and I didn't pay for either. What, like, how do we get so far away from that sort of childlike wonder and gratefulness? Mm-hmm. And so we've been fighting to get back there ever since, yeah. Of like getting back to the childlike wonder and no expectancy, because expectancy is kind of like the fun killer.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that, Paul.
That was such a rant. I apologize.
No, it's good because it takes us right where a place where I wanted to go. Because one of the notes I took in prepping for this conversation is one of the things I appreciate you in following you on social media and even just watching your work is that I do get a great sense of gratitude from you. I do sense that you are very, very grateful. You feel very blessed to do this work. But what you're saying is that's something you've had to work on.
Oh yeah. Not because I'm not grateful, but you do negate gratefulness and gratitude or whatever. You negate it when you, or overshadow it when you want so much more. And it's not wrong from a place of like fun passion. If you have a passion in you, that's like, oh, I passionately want to do a Western someday and I want to direct a movie and I want to do a music video. Good. That's not bad. But when that takes over the narrative and it's only about excelling and beating this checklist in your head, it's like, that's not a very, in my opinion, it's not a healthy way to live. I'm always at my best when I'm, you know, the Bible talks about this. There's a verse that talks about when you go to a wedding banquet or some event, you're supposed to sit in the back. There's somebody sees you in the back and is like, why are you sitting in the back? You should be at one of the head tables. Then you, of course, have humbled yourself, which you should always do. And then you get the spoils of someone deciding you belong somewhere else. Like, awesome. I have to remind myself of that, because if too many good things happen, you start to go, well, this is just my life. I guess my life, I'm always eating lobster and drinking this expensive IPA and putting my feet on the chair. And it's like, no, dummy, that's not where you came from. You came from a place where your mom and dad had to pinch pennies and buy ghetto cereal because they were paying for private Christian school tuition, which may or may not have been a good thing. I don't know some days, but I'm grateful for my relationship with God. So I wouldn't really take it back, but at the same time, that always makes me laugh a little too.
Well, tell me more about that relationship with God. Like, what role does your faith play in your art, and then in your life as a recognizable actor? What role does your faith play?
I mean, there's a church I attended in LA called Reality LA in Hollywood. And I love the place. Jeremy Treat, their pastor, has been a very good mentor to me and friend at times when I really needed him. But there was a pastor there who now started a church, a reality in London. His name escapes me. Really good looking guy, wrote a book that describes like every pastor. But this guy said the term emotional modesty. He was doing a course on like dating and singleness. And, you know, there's a bunch of sad 26-year-olds who, you know, don't want to admit to their porn addiction in the same room, essentially. But the guy's telling us, he's like, you know, you have to have emotional modesty. You can't tell everybody every part about yourself immediately because it literally scares people away. So when I do these interviews and podcasts, sometimes I have to practice emotional modesty because I'm just like, I'm ready to spill my guts to anybody, whether it's the Pope or a homeless guy, but, that might not be good. So for me, God, my relationship to God is I need it. Even if it wasn't true, and there was no God, I would still do this to maintain civility and the fruits of the Spirit. To just be a good person, because I am a sinner and I mess up and I suck a lot of times. So there's that, but I do believe it's true. And I do love Jesus. And that's a part of my personal growth. Forgive me. I have fruit flies in my apartment right now. I swear it's like the plague here, man. I've been in New Orleans for 5 months and I have battled spiritual warfare. We had a bunch of production issues. We had a hurricane come through. I decided to just get sober randomly in the middle of the shoot and haven't had a drink in 50 days. We've had fruit flies in my trailer, fruit flies in my apartment. We had our air conditioning break. I got COVID. It's been crazy. Mm-hmm. Hashtag thank you, God, for sustaining me amidst all this crazy. God is my source of growth. He's how I understand even pieces of the world and myself. And then in my work, I think my faith affects my work because, you know, on my best day, I'm always like, you know, I want to be better. Mm-hmm. And on my worst day, I am able to practice grace for myself. Yeah. So it works in both extremes and capacities, I think. And it shows me how to love people that aren't always lovable.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think in our current world with the political climate, and I say political climate because outside of politics, you don't see this, but everybody kind of hates each other, or at least they promote that vibe. And I kind of just like, I kind of look at the world right now and I wonder, is there selective empathy? You know, mm-hmm. is everybody choosing to love a certain type and not everybody? And I didn't come up with selective empathy. I read an article and I stole that term, but I think Jesus Christ allows me to have empathy for everybody and love everybody rather than join the torch brigade and just want to hate everybody for whatever random infraction they've committed this week. I'm a screw up. I wouldn't want to be held to that standard, you know? Yeah. So that's the long ranty way of explaining how God affects my daily life and my work life. Yeah.
Well, you know, as a pastor, I'm totally biased. I think it's got to be essential to everything that you're doing, right? You know, but I would think at the very least, you know, the notion that the reality of, you know, the grace that comes to us through Jesus, the reality of the grace that comes to us through Christ, it It keeps us grateful, which you've said is important for the work that you do. It keeps us grounded, which is important, I would think, for the world that you live in, right? But then also it gives us this notion, and this comes from that kind of Lutheran background that you share with me, of I am simultaneously two things. I am a sinner, completely and utterly, but I'm also a saint in the eyes of God. So like my worth in the eyes of the Creator is set, yet I get to still be brutally honest about my humanity and my brokenness and all my issues. Like I'm free to be honest about that.
Also, your issues don't surprise God. Like there's some lame thing they teach in church and schools where they tell kids all the time, they're like, your sins made the Savior weep. And then they hand you a freaking Kleenex. Like, there's so much guilt wrapped into faith in a lot of places, not every place, but a lot of them. God is not on the guilt train. God's not like, I want to guilt you into submission and believing in me. Mm-hmm. That's the lamest un-God thing ever. Yeah. God freaking loves you, only wants you to acknowledge sin because it's hurting you. Mm-hmm. God's in heaven. It's not like he's got one foot in our water and he's like, I'm still feeling the nails on the cross. No, dude, that is done. One and done, bro.
Yeah.
You don't make that kind of sacrifice so that it can echo into eternity.
Yeah.
He's living out the riches of his sacrifice too. It's not just us. So
that's a good point. That's a good point.
Let's not play the game where God is watching us like the Truman Show, crying his eyes out all day. Not true, but that is what is communicated quite often. So my thing with that is, you know, and once again, I'm getting a little tangential, but back to the point of, you know, it is a relationship. There are some celebrities I've met who claim to be believers in God or Jesus. And I talk with them and they don't go to church. And I used to look at it like, what is your deal that you don't go to church? I used to kind of judge that. But they live a different life where they've been hurt in unique ways. And they've been ostracized in unique ways. And maybe their church is what we're doing now. Maybe it's on a laptop watching it on YouTube. Maybe that's their church. And I can't really judge that anymore. I used to think it was bad form. But, you know, can Jim Carrey walk into a church and be treated normal? Probably not.
Yeah.
I talked to an NFL quarterback who I won't say who it is. And I won't say who the person is, but I talked to an NFL quarterback who famously went to or attended a mega church. And I won't say which one and who, but the pastor there was kind of grabby and like kind of liked the flavor of celebrity.
Yeah.
And so that guy ended up feeling grossed out and didn't go to the church.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we got to be careful how we treat those people. Like there should be a calm equanimity to how we embrace everyone, both in the church and out of the church. And I see that too on movie sets where somebody treats a background extra or an assistant like crap. But then when Joe Schmo with the Oscar walks on, it's like, hey man. And everybody's like suddenly all over him. And it's like, dude, that is such bad form. Like, don't you see that when someone treats a server poorly at a restaurant?
Absolutely. And the New Testament goes at great lengths to say, look, this thing that we believe is meant to actually break down all those things. I mean, so you look at like letters in the New Testament where it says rich and poor, black, white, all these things, these things that we use to divide and subjugate, these don't exist in the kingdom of heaven, right? And so we should try to replicate that when people walk into the church. Like we sit side by side, shoulder to shoulder, but that is such a difficult thing to actually live out, right?
Or like, you know, like a homeless guy, like if you're sitting next to him, you know, on a bus or a subway, whatever, it's like, oh, he smells. Do you get up and leave? It's like, dude, if Christ bore a crown of thorns, I think he can handle the scent of someone else for 9 minutes in a bus. Like there's just a lot of things and by the way, it's human. We all do it. Our reaction to pain is how do I immediately eradicate this? That's why we have extra strength Tylenol. It's not because we were trying a new flavor of pill. It's because we want this to go away as soon as humanly possible. But that pain and that discomfort and that awkwardness is often God's will, literally. Not because he's poking at us like a voodoo doll. He's doing it because he's like, well, like anything, a lot of this is kind of practice for the scrimmage or the game, you know? And if you didn't have that pain or those experiential moments, how are you supposed to navigate anything with thoughtful, wisdom-led authority?
Yeah.
You won't have it. By the way, this is fun, just talking. I feel like I'm talking to people I've known for years. So, like, don't look at the clock. Cut it off. I have nothing going on. Cut it off when you want to cut it off. I'm not on a time crunch here.
Sounds good, man. Well, I'm having a good time too. So tell me this, you know, you've been acting in movies for 11, 12 years now, it sounds like. And yet in the last 5-6 years, my sense of knowing your work a little bit is that things have really, really changed for you over the last 5 or 6 years with some really prominent roles.
Yeah. Like the last 4 years. Yeah. This time, literally this week, 4 years ago, I was at the Toronto Film Festival for the I, Tonya premiere. And that was a really neat moment because we didn't really know what we had. It's kind of like, Dr. Frankenstein and his monster. We made this weird thing in a basement that we thought was cool, but we didn't know if they were going to come with pitchforks or roses, you know?
Yeah.
And very luckily, we were embraced at that festival, and we were right at the top of the heap with like 3 billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri, that movie with Rockwell and McDormand. Yeah. Like it was a really crazy moment where I was once again free shrimp, right? Mm-hmm. I was just happy to be there. I wasn't expecting, I wasn't being cocky or icky. I was just really like tearfully grateful. I remember a moment walking into the Toronto Film Festival hotel that I got. Because once again, they didn't pay for my stuff. I was like putting myself up, just wanted to be there, wanted to be a part of it, you know? And I go into my, I'm getting goosebumps, man. I'm getting emotional thinking about it. Yeah. There's a photo I took of my hotel room. I looked out the window and I did the classic, you know, I felt like Kevin McAllister in Home Alone 2. I'm in New York City. Oh my God. You know, I'm peeling the blinds back and looking out the giant window of my high rise. And the word dream is etched on a building like next door to the building I'm in. And it just felt like a wave from God, just a little like poke and a wave like, hey, buddy, I know how hard you've worked. This is one of those moments. You get to have one of these moments. And I was sober that weekend, too. I didn't drink a lick of anything. I kept a Canada Dry can from that weekend because I was so proud of myself. But I had like one of the greatest weekends of my life. And that movie really allowed everybody to see what I can do. And I'm so grateful that it's a fun little calling card that led to a lot of other things.
Yeah. But all the things it's led to have been really incredible. Of course, you know, Richard Jewell and one of my favorites, Cobra Kai, and a whole bunch of other things. A new movie right now called Queen Pins, where you're working with Vince Vaughn. You get to do comedy alongside Vince Vaughn. But all of that, when that wave starts to come and your life, I would imagine, really starts to change in some substantive ways, that has to be disorienting, right? When suddenly you're recognized in places and you're working alongside people you haven't been able to work alongside before, or maybe I'm wrong. Is it not disorienting? I'm assuming it would. Like, it kind of turns everything upside down.
Disorienting is a really good word. I don't think the disorienting part happened until Richard Jewell. Everything before that was like, this is where I should be. I should be the husky character actor who jumps into a courtroom drama and jumps out to do a sitcom. Like, I always thought that was who I was going to be as an actor. And a lot of my favorite actors did that. Like John Goodman. John Goodman was like working with the Coen brothers while doing Roseanne. I knew I could do that. I wanted to do that. And that was exactly what I was doing around that time. What I didn't really think would happen is getting a phone call saying Clint Eastwood wants you to star in his movie. That was like once again, I've told the story a million times, and I'll just give the beat points really quickly, which are, oh God, it's so crazy. By the way, I say God now. I don't say Jesus Christ as a curse word, but now I say God all the time because I realize it's really just an exhalation that points to God because of some moment of strife or just grateful disbelief. So I've taken the the childhood guilt out of saying, oh God, or God, or oh my God. Oh man, I'm the son of a pastor too. My brother is a sixth generation Lutheran pastor.
Is he really?
Resides in Michigan. So the roots are deep, as thick as they could be, man. Yeah. They're real thick. So it's funny how I have to undo little structural things that my brain thought were concrete growing up. It's humorous if it wasn't so consequential to those who are afraid of those things. What the hell were we talking about? I'm so sorry.
No, I was asking you about how once fame really hits, how disorienting it is.
Yeah. Disorienting. Good word. So what is disorienting is when the person who doesn't text you anymore decides to start texting you. What's disorienting is when a beautiful woman who ghosted me is inviting me to a party all of a sudden. What's disorienting is when you're suddenly believing things that are crazy, and then you find out they're not crazy and they're real. Like some huge director who makes blockbuster movies offering me $750,000 to star in their new, you know, space epic or something. That those things started to happen and it was exciting, but it was also a lot at once and you didn't know who to trust. I still don't know who to trust. There are still moments where I give somebody a chance, they prove untrustworthy, and then I'm the one slowly ghosting them. And it's not because I hate them, but it's because life is short. I have a demanding schedule, and I can't handle those things sometimes. You know, and that part is disorienting, I would say. But the work itself, you know, that's the joy. Everything outside of the work, that can be really frustrating. You know, that can be tough.
So what role did your faith play?
You also said, like, getting recognized. Yeah. That stuff is fun, man. That, like, I'm into it. When somebody wants to take a photo or they get emotional and they tell me that they saw Richard Jewell with their grandmother, it's the last movie they saw in theaters with her, like, that stuff is awesome. And even if I'm busy and I'm headed somewhere and someone tries to stop me, at the very least, I'll always try to make them feel seen. Because we all want that, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Is that when some gratitude kicks in? Do you feel gratitude when it's like, does that make the, oh, I'm blessed to do this? Does that
always
make that
come to life? I'll retweet somebody and just say, thanks for watching my movie. Cause I'm like, dude, there's a billion movies in existence. You don't have to go see Queen Pins. If you do, it means a lot to me. It's cool.
Yeah. And you know, coming from where you came from, and like we mentioned earlier, you and I are from the same part of the world. If someone who's in movies that you watch and TV shows that you watch does something as simple as like your tweet when you live in Saginaw, Michigan, that's like the most important thing that's ever happened to you.
Bro, I want to immediately tell a story based on what you just said. And I'm so grateful you said it because I haven't told this story yet. I don't think man, this is so messed up. I played a mortgage banker in a movie called Adam that we shot in Detroit at One Reverse Mortgage and Quicken Loans buildings in Detroit. It's me, Jeff Daniels, Aaron Paul, great cast. The movie's just meh, but great people tried to make a good movie. I filmed that playing a mortgage banker. 6 months later, I'm working in Saginaw at a bowling alley and a butcher shop. And I'm like living with my parents. So the LA thing, I only lived in LA for a year, the year I moved out. I ran out of money. I was sleeping on someone's floor. I was depressed. It was bad. I go home to Michigan. I work some menial day jobs at a grocery store and a bowling alley. Eventually, I'm not making enough money to save to move back to LA, which is the whole point of working like these jobs. So I moved down to Detroit to become a mortgage banker. I literally got a job as an associate mortgage banker at the place I played a mortgage banker a year and a half after I shot it. You can't write that. I mean, you can, but it's wild. So the whole point of me saying that, because what did you say to kickstart this?
No, just like being in the middle of Michigan and somebody in Hollywood likes a tweet.
Thank you. So the whole point of me telling that weird story is while I was working as a mortgage banker at Quicken Loans in Detroit, I was tweeting one day. I was really sad. This guy, Jack Gilbert, who is an exec or a script consultant at Warner Brothers, a Christian dude who taught me some stuff at a conference once, a workshop. He died and I was depressed. And I found a song by Loudon Wainwright, this folk musician. And I loved the song so much and it was kind of cheering me up. And I remember that I only knew of Loudon Wainwright because of the Judd Apatow movie Knocked Up. That was the first time I heard the guy's music. So I just thanked Judd and said, you know, Loudon Wainwright, this music is really cheering me up today. And Judd liked it or retweeted it. And it made such an impact on me because I was not because it meant anything. It was just him clicking twice or whatever.
Yeah.
But it meant something to me because I was sad and depressed. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, if I can click something and it makes somebody happy for a couple hours. Awesome. I hope so. And now, like, I've taken a meeting with Judd Apatow. I've been to his office. Him and his wife are fans of Richard Jewell.
So, wait, like, you've sat down with Judd and Leslie?
Leslie wasn't there, but Judd made a big stink that I think he said she paused the movie during the movie and just said, like, did you see what Paul just did? Did you see the thing he just did or whatever? Like, I don't know.
How cool is that? Leslie Mann is, like, amazing, right? I mean, Judd's fantastic, but Leslie Mann is an incredible actress.
By the way, does anyone do comedy anger better than Leslie Mann?
No. No.
Probably not.
No.
Probably not. Her and Don Rickles, maybe? I don't know. I think they're brilliant. And, like, it's not hard. It's confounding when I look back at the fact that I was such a fan of Sam Rockwell. Still am, obviously. But, I mean, like, I would do interviews back in 2015. And every interview, I'd bring up Sam Rockwell and be like, my favorite actors are Peter Sarsgaard, Sam Rockwell, Michael Shannon. I'd list like five guys. The fact that I did a Clint Eastwood movie with him is crazy.
Yeah.
It'll never not be crazy to me.
Right. Well, like,
I'll never get over that.
And just to bring that up, like my favorite moment in that movie, and I think one of my favorite like actor moments that I've ever witnessed is in the scene where you're sitting in the restaurant with Sam Rockwell toward the end, and Don Draper comes over and he hands you the letter that says the case is over, and then Sam Rockwell looks at you as Richard Jewell, and says to Richard, it's over. And your choice to just kind of take a beat and let it hit you, and then you take a bite of the donut before a word is said, was just so real and powerful, man. Was that bite of the donut in the script, or was that just a choice you made in that moment?
Our kiddo definitely has big emotions. And part of it is that, you know, those tantrums were lasting for a really long amount of time, like way above what I think sometimes they say. Hours. I mean, yeah, they were just so long. So I think for sure with some of the techniques, like the light switch, which was one of the first things we learned with you guys, the duration of those immediately started to cut down.
I made that choice while reading the script weeks before I shot it.
Yeah.
Once again, it pays to be a consumer of the thing you create. Mm-hmm. So there are some choices I make sometimes, and they aren't. People can define it however they want. I sometimes get a little nauseated by people giving me too much credit. But I will say, like, being a consumer of movies, in that moment, I was thinking, if I'm an audience member, what does that moment mean for me? And for me, I'm watching the movie. I'm seeing this guy get crapped on for 90 minutes, 2 hours. And like, you're almost teasing the audience by not crying right away.
Yeah.
You're kind of holding it in. And, you know, Michael Caine famously said, good film crying is trying not to cry.
Yeah.
So I took those two methodology ideologies and just thought, well, he's not trying to cry in front of another grown man in a public setting. Yep. Nobody wants to do that.
Yep.
I'm eating the donut in that moment because it's me going, oh, I can enjoy myself again.
Mm.
Or like, I'm free. This is a freedom-based choice. Yep. So you taking the bite is a choice of just, I'm happy. I have freedom. But then when you start to chew and you're eating it, yep, you're tasting it. And tasting it is different than picking it up. We all know that. And tasting it and chewing it and swallowing it is a different kind of freedom. So it's feeling all the micro emotions that would lead to that. And then on top of it, in between takes, I'm listening to Jerry Goldsmith's musical score of the movie Rudy. And I'm remembering, like, Paul, not Richard. Paul used to watch Rudy and dream about being a lead actor in a dramatic film. And here I am doing it. And sorry, I gotta pull back a little bit. It's emotional thinking about it again, because I can put myself back in that booth and feel everything like it happened this morning.
Yeah.
And then Rockwell, who's one of my favorite actors, is sitting right across from me. So like, it's not hard to conjure emotion when you put that many deep-seated feelings in one pot and bring it to a boil.
Yeah.
So really, I never went to acting school. I'm not trained classically. There are days I wish I was. And I think like, maybe I should have went to, you know, I don't know, Carnegie Mellon or something. I probably couldn't get into any of those schools anyway, so it probably doesn't matter. I still would have been at like the Clio Playhouse outside of Saginaw or something. But I say all this to say, you know, I'm not classically trained, but anyone can act. It doesn't mean we have the versatility to be Daniel Day or Glenn Close, but everybody can act because we all feel feelings, man. Yeah. That's at the end of the day, that's all it is. Can you replicate a feeling honestly? And in that moment, between the score of Rudy, looking at Rockwell, meditating on my journey, and then meditating on Richard's journey,
yeah,
easy to do at that point. It's not even attributable to talent. It's just attributable to emotional cognizance.
Yeah. Well, what made that moment real is that it was a real moment for you. And the camera caught it, right? And then, but that choice to let silence speak for that moment, and we watch you feel those feelings, just let the silence spoke louder than anything you could have done. You just paused, you took that bite, you took that beat, and then we watched the tears well in your eyes, and like the viewer is just with you and they're done. So, you know, it was a great moment.
Everybody tries to attribute this to the devil. I'm taking it back for JC.
There you go.
This is now ours. The devil doesn't get that. This is rock and roll. And in the words of the famous Christian band Petra, God gave rock and roll to you, gave rock and roll to me, put it in the soul of everyone. That's right.
So Paul, you know, you strike me as someone who, you know, you have a steady head on your shoulders. You're grounded in your faith. And I know you're human like the rest of us, but what's it like though? You have this, you know, grounding in your faith and a good head on your shoulders. What's it like meeting some of these famous people that you never thought you'd meet when you were growing up? Do you still get, I mean, now a handful of years into this, where you've worked with like everybody who's big in the world, do you still get moments where you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that this person is standing right next to me. Does that happen?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think I've gotten better at not looking at it like that. You know, it's like what Tarantino said in Pulp Fiction, you know, Travolta and Thurman sit down to that meal in the 50s diner. And Travolta says it's like a wax museum with a pulse. It's a brilliant, brilliant line of dialogue. And it also describes some of these parties you go to. You know, I've been to... This is not a good way to deal with it. Once again, I'm just being honest. I have nothing to lose, really. There was a party at CAA, the agency I am represented by. And I usually bring a buddy. I always have like a buddy, a female friend, a family member, whatever, come to these events because it's fun to bring somebody, to have someone to socialize with and to have someone get to experience the fun of it, because it does get old for some of us and it gets a little less glitzy. But for someone who doesn't live that lifestyle, they're like, you know, eating baklava and drinking, you know, a $30 shot and talking to the producer of The Revenant. You know, it's a fun night for somebody. But I had a night where I didn't go with anybody and I was like kind of lonely and didn't really want to go, but knew I should go and socialize and make a thing of it. So I just, because I've been to those parties where nobody talks to you and then you feel like a freshman at a senior party and it's the worst. So I took an edible and went to one of these parties, and it was fun at the beginning. And I'm just kind of walking around and I had like this good vibe on where I was very much just kind of loose and happy. And then at some point the edibles took a turn and I was terrified. And I had like Todd Phillips and James Corden talking to me. And I go, guys, I cannot talk to you right now. I am a little too high and need to leave the conversation. And like, I'm like grubbing and eating like cocktail wieners in the corner of this party. And then just ordered an Uber and was like, I can't do it. This is bad. So I say all that to say that's the bad version of one of those nights. The good version is, yeah, good and bad. But the good version is I went to another party around the same time frame where I went with my buddy Abigail Spencer, who is a fellow believer as well. And we had a fun night where we like, I didn't drink. I didn't have to take any substances. I just went and I had so much fun just having really clarified conversations with people where I could be a better listener to them and I could make it about them and not make it about me. And those conversations, I really, you know, when I say conversations, I mean like I'm talking to DiCaprio, Chris Evans, Scarlett Johansson, Shia LaBeouf, Josh, like I'm talking to all these people and we're having real human conversations rather than we're both a little buzzed, surface level, congratulatory crap. Yeah. And that stuff I love, you know, I love saying to Scarlett Johansson and Colin Jost, what can I pray for? Give me something I can pray. And by the way, all these people immediately give me something to pray for, right. You know, like, you know, Bradley Cooper and I had a really nice moment where we both got to tell each other that we were going to hold each other accountable and pray for something for each other. And we have, I haven't seen him in years, but like, I know we're still praying for each other. Like that's stuff like that is really, it means a lot to me. So I think, you know, there are times where those encounters and those events can be kind of treacherous and you either don't go or you go and you have a drink in your hand the whole night. And then other times they can be really, really kind of fun ways to love other people and try to minister to people that feel like crap. And, you know, even though they're dressed to the nines and they look amazing. We're all hurting, man.
Yeah.
We're all hurting.
Yeah.
We all need people to ask us how we're doing and to pray for us or to vent with us and sit in that moment. We all need that.
Do you like stories of inspiration, stories of faith, stories of encouragement? Then I hope you will check out my podcast where I interview people of faith who share their stories of encouragement, their stories of inspiration, their stories of hope, and overcoming trials and difficulties that they have faced in their life and that we have faced in our lives as well. Hope you check it out.
there's this sense that Hollywood is a place that's not really amenable to people of faith. But what you're saying is that you've been able to be pretty open about the things that you believe, and you found that there's a lot of kinship there.
Yeah, there's that statement isn't true at all. That's a divisive political thing that people try to mandate as if Hollywood hates Christianity and doesn't love outsiders. Hollywood is the home of outsiders. Hollywood wants to love on everybody, but it's how you approach it. If you come from some hierarchical, aggressive place, if that's where you come from in the tonality of your representation of faith, who the hell would, who would want to embrace that? Hmm. It's like the people, you know, back when my buddy Evan Chisholm turned 21 and we, you know, scoured the streets of East Lansing on his 21st birthday I think we got a limo with his parents and it was like some celebratory thing. We're going in and out of bars and there's people with signs that say, you know, so-and-so is going to hell, and they list off gay people. And it's like, dude, even if you believe that, do you actually think that that's, do you think that that's an appropriate way in which to get your point across or to gain favor from anyone? Mm-hmm. You're a lunatic if you believe that. Mm-hmm. And I just think that at the end of the day, how you treat people will be your gravestone. That'll be your resume. That'll be your farewell. How you treat people. It doesn't matter if you're a Muslim. Doesn't matter if you're a Christian. Doesn't matter if you believe in crunchy peanut butter. If you treat people like crap, there's your legacy. Yeah. So I've been very fortunate where the times I've shared my faith with everyone from an A-lister to a guy swinging a hammer on a TV set, they're embracive of me, not because they believe in everything I believe in, but because I'm trying to respect them and love them. Isn't that what we all want? I mean,
well, it's like what I loved your point that, you know, in the end, how you treat people is what your legacy is going to be. You know, it made me think of what Tim Keller says, that the greatest proof of what you believe is how it causes you to treat other people. You know, the greatest apologetic for the trustworthiness and the truth of, you know, the theology you stand on or stand behind is how it leads you to treat people. Right.
Yeah, man. And like, let's even bring it out of the faith element and talk, because I think that parables and metaphors are the greatest way to get through to people, because we're human and we need to see things in a different context. Sometimes same lens, different environment. So Christians have a thing where, because of the gospel, we feel compelled to share it, which is understandable. It's amazing. The scandal of grace is a big deal. But if I just learned how to use a slap chop or a food ninja or a blender or an easy bake oven, I'm going to go around being like, holy crap. This is how you make homemade salsa. Give me 10 minutes of your time. You'll never be the same. Christians are wonderful people, but they're at their most fallible when they feel that they've graduated from the class. Mm. A lot of us feel like we are chefs because we learned how to use a blender. It's very cute, but it's also wayward. We haven't graduated from 4 years of Le Cordon Bleu in France. So we need to do this thing where, you know, people are so afraid of faith journey because they feel like, what if you go on a detour and you lose your way? What if you lose the breadcrumbs? Mm. It doesn't happen. What does God say? Nothing can separate you from the love of God. Mm-hmm. Height nor death, nor angels, nor demons, nor... If you read that, then don't be so afraid to talk to your friend who does tarot cards. Don't be so afraid to watch a rated R movie. Nothing can separate you. You are learning as a human. You're learning. Now, if you're delighting in something horrific, don't do it, obviously.
Yeah.
You have discernment as a person.
Yeah.
But as far as the experience, you are gaining experience in the world to inform your faith journey and to make you better at being that person. So it's not about capturing the hearts and going, I told 10 people about Jesus today. It should be, did your food taste so good that these people are coming back and asking, what is the recipe?
Hmm.
You don't want them asking for the food. You want them asking for the recipe.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. How did you get this? How did you make this? What's the secret? Oh, I got it. It's this grace that never runs out, that is free and for everybody and for you, right?
And let them come to you, man, because who likes the pamphlet in the door? Right. You know, I put my gum between those pamphlets.
Right.
I mean, because, by the way, if someone's saved from a pamphlet or a 1-800 number on a public access station, good. That just proves the gospel is even stronger than we know. Mm-hmm. But more than likely, it's going to come out of relationship and you living out the fruits of the Spirit. Mm-hmm. That if somebody is drinking that fruits of the Spirit smoothie, they go, I got to know what's in this.
Yeah. Well, like you said earlier, you know, no one gets guilted or shamed into doing anything, at least not for very long, right? What motivates people to change, what motivates people to believe is love. You know, I could scream at my kids and demand obedience, and I might get, at best, I will get dismayed, frustrated obedience for a while, at best, but I won't get love. I won't get a desire to walk in line with the will of dad. I won't get a greater depth of our connection. I won't get that. Only love can do that. Only love can do that.
And if you come 100%, and if you come at it from a place of fear,
yeah,
if that's the entry point, which, you know, I don't know much about Catholicism, but it sure seems like there for a lot of lapsed Catholics, their biggest gripe is that they were brought into faith by way of fear and not love.
Yeah.
And sort of stern, borderline aggressive instruction rather than an invite to some sort of spirited faith-based intellectualism, which is what it should be at the end of the day. Like, we should never stop reading the Word of God. We should never stop opening our friend circle to different kinds of people, because you never graduate from wisdom. It only sharpens or redefines. Yeah. So to me, that's the journey. And that's also why, am I a proud believer in Jesus Christ? Hell yeah. Am I going to promulgate it as if I have all the answers and can fix people? No, because I have a stain on my sweatshirt and fruit flies in my face and COVID and my bank account goes up and down and I can't keep a relationship together and I sin and I get arrogant and I get forgetful. And why would I be a teacher of the very, why would I try to be a pharmacist of the pill I'm taking? It's just very, very obvious that we need brothers and sisters to link arms more than we need teachers to tell us what to do.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
To me, that's obvious.
Absolutely. So Paul, tell us, what are you working on now? What are you excited about?
Two questions, two separate answers. I'm excited to be done with this shoot. It's been a long shoot. I'm playing a serial killer for a limited series. It's a true crime, true story based on the murders of a guy named Larry Hall, who I believe is locked up in North Carolina or South Carolina. He was a serial killer. He admitted to, I think, maybe a dozen or 14 murders and some of them involved rape of these young women, but he may have done upwards of 20, 30, 40 of these. They don't actually know because he's been very revisionist history on the whole thing. He's been very misleading and crazy regarding his accounts, but I play that guy. And Taron Egerton plays the sort of, you know, the, like DiCaprio in The Departed. Taron is the character who factually, this guy who got placed in that prison to get a forced confession out of my character, my guy. So that will be on Apple Plus, I think spring of next year, hopefully. And, you know, it sounds like a dark story that a lot of your viewers and listeners might not want to watch. But the reality is, you know, the Bible is the most R-rated book in history. Beheadings, incest, people killed for reasons that are seemingly unexplainable. So let's all calm down and get off our high horse. True crime is dope. Everybody loves true crime. Some sick part of us is fascinated by it. And then the other human part of us is just, we want to know if it's redemptive or if it ends the way of the world. And I think, you know, our story has both gloomy, irredemptive parts and beautiful, legitimate redemptive parts. And that's life. So I'm really proud to portray that. It's been a pain in the ass to do because it's taken a long time, but I'm very grateful for the job. And I couldn't ask for a better dance partner. Taron Egerton is like, I mean, watch Kingsman, watch Eddie the Eagle, watch Rocket Man. I mean, the guy is clearly one of the next great, great actors, similar to Leo. Leo had that run between like What's Eating Gilbert Grape and Catch Me If You Can. I think Taron's right in the middle of that run where he's doing his Romeo and Juliet and The Beach. And, you know, and Man with the Iron Mask, Catch Me If You Can. He's in that pocket of doing really meaningful leading man work as a young guy. So I'm happy for him and, you know, happy for me. I'm getting to, it's actor candy. Every actor wants to play a serial killer or a druggie, something where you have to immerse and do something icky because it's fascinating. You know, it's interesting.
And tell us just a little bit before we let you go. Tell us a little bit about Queen Pins. This is your movie out right now.
What a fun movie. Yeah. Kristen Bell, America's, her and Dax Shepard are like America's sweethearts, man.
They are.
By the way, another reason I think people take to me sometimes is similar to Kristen and Dax. They don't hide their flaws. They're very transparent. They're very open with the public. And they work really hard to entertain and love people. And I try to do the same. So I was thrilled to work with her, even in a small capacity. I think we only have one or two scenes together. Kirby Howell-Baptiste, who I worked with in Cruella, is also in Queen Pins.
Yeah.
And she is just, I think she maybe steals the movie. I mean, for me, she made me laugh more than me, Kristen, or Vince. And then Vince Vaughn is, of course, one of my comedy heroes. I've gotten to become friends with him through Sam Rockwell. Rockwell hit me up back in like, it was right before COVID. I think it was like December of 2019. Rockwell hit me up and was like, do you want to go to Bill Burr's Christmas party with me and Vince Vaughn? And I was like, I don't know. Do I have a terminal illness? Because that sounds like a make-a-wish. So I became friends with Vince through Sam and was very grateful to meet him. And they didn't have that role cast when they cast me. And I said to them, they were talking about some like 50, 60-year-old action stars to play that guy. And I was like, you know, it's a comedy. What if we go with like someone more comedically inclined? What about Vince Vaughn? And they go, Vince would be great. Do you know him? And I go, I sure do. So like, I think in front of them that day at the restaurant, in front of the filmmakers, I literally texted the PDF script copy to Vince. And 3-4 months later, he was attached. So I felt like a mini producer bringing Vince into the fold and elevating the movie. And here we are, you know, a year and a half later, or whatever it's been. And I hope people watch it. I really love playing the character, the LPO, the loss prevention officer, Ken Miller. He's kind of a stickler for the rules and is kind of a kind of pencil pusher, you know, would have been much more popular in the 1950s type, similar to Richard Jewell probably. Yeah. But I love that guy deeply. And I think, you know, he's a composite of a lot of well-meaning people who sometimes have disastrous execution. Yeah. So happy to play him. I'll probably be playing that type the rest of my life. And I think it's funny, you know, I improvise like a dozen lines that made it into the film. And I always get a kick out of that. You know, I think it's like an inside joke with myself almost, where I'll say something on the day that I'll make up and it makes it into the movie. I always get a kick out of that. So I really hope people see the movie. Super proud of that. And then I got another movie coming out called Delia's Gone. It's kind of a dark character study, starring me, Marissa Tomei, and Stefan James, who is the lead in, he played in If Beale Street Could Talk, the Barry Jenkins film. And Homecoming, that show with Julia Roberts. Yeah. He was the lead of that. So I hope people check those out. That'd be wonderful. Nice.
Wonderful. Well, Paul, you've been incredibly generous with your time. Thank you for joining us on the show today.
Let's make a deal. If you're still doing this, if you're still doing this podcast and I win like my first trophy or award or something within like 48 hours, we'll do another podcast and we'll have like a little celebration where we can thank God for how far he's brought me on this journey.
That is a deal. Amen. Let's make it happen. And I guarantee you, I don't think it's going to be too long until that day comes. But when, however long it takes, man, we're going to keep doing this show just because of that. All right.
Well, I'm sending you got my email. I just put it in the Zoom chat and hit me up when that day comes. A giant, you're going to have to put like in giant caps. Yo,
got it.
Daddy Pops is back for round two. Rachel's ready to go, and right. I'll sit in bed with a sweaty tuxedo and a drink in my hand and a trophy.
And we'll give God all the glory, right?
I mean, that's who to give it to, man. It's what McConaughey said when he won the Oscar. Too many things have happened that are not by my hand or the hand of anyone else. And yeah. I don't say that to be cute. I don't say it to try to construct humility. But when you get a phone call, when you're sitting in your underwear in a hotel in Thailand and your agent calls you and goes, Clint Eastwood would like you to be the lead of his next film. That's not me, dude. That's not me.
That's right, man. From Saginaw, Michigan to a Clint Eastwood movie. Hey, man, thank you. Thank you so much for the time. And we really appreciate it. Look forward to the next time we can chat.
Well, lucky man. Thanks for making me feel cool. Love you guys. Peace. Mm-hmm.
So, Rachel, that was so much fun, wasn't it?
Oh man, I can't stop smiling. That was it was just delightful. It's fun to just like talk to somebody and have I just loved it.
Yeah, hanging out with him was a lot of fun. It just felt like we were longtime friends, and we got to talk about a whole bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. So it was a good bit of fun, and he was willing to even like, you know, make a promise to us that if he ever wins an award for his acting, he made a promise that Make It Simple will be the first show that he goes on and we will get the first interview and we will give thanks to God together for his success. How about that?
That was really cool. It was so sweet. Like just so sweet. Yeah.
And we're going to hold him to it. Stay subscribed to the podcast. Watch for Paul Walter Hauser to, you know, win his Oscar, his Golden Globe, whatever he's going to get. And then stay tuned because he will be on this podcast shortly thereafter. That was his promise. We're going to hold him to it.
Yeah. You know, like we said, he really just brought to the conversation how he lives life, how he just navigates this world. And whether you're a celebrity or not, just this idea of, like we said, how you treat people matters. Am I grateful? Am I thankful? Like, am I always going for the next thing? Or am I thankful for what I have right now? Like, this is the thing, the waiting, all of it. This is the thing, the working it. And what a cool perspective. Like, what a great way to live your life.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the things that I appreciated about what he shared was the essential nature of gratitude as you do this, not forgetting where you came from, not forgetting how much of a privilege it is to get to do the things you've wanted to do. And I think that translates to all professions, to all walks of life. You may not be on a Hollywood film set, but life itself is a gift. And the things we've been called to do, you know, in the home, in the marketplace, wherever we find ourselves, it's all a get to. It's not a have to. And if we have our eyes opened to the goodness of God, we'll see that we have incredible amounts of things to be grateful for. And so I'm thankful for his reminding us of the essential nature of gratitude in his work and really in all the work that we do. But overall, it was just a fun conversation. And we hope you guys enjoyed this departure from the norm for us, eavesdropping on our chat with Paul Walter Hauser. Maybe we'll do this again. We'll find somebody else and we'll just have a nice long conversation with somebody who's really interesting. No topic, really, no agenda. just hanging out online with Matt and Rachel.
I like it.
Yeah, awesome. All right, so I'm gonna go watch Cobra Kai because I've actually not seen it. My brother's really into it, but I've actually not seen it, so I need to see it now. So that's what I'm gonna go do. What are you gonna go watch?
I'm gonna go watch Queenpin.
There you go. All right, you guys at home, go watch something as well, and we'll catch you next time on the next episode of Make It Simple. Thanks for helping us make it simple. The show is produced by MPM. Our editor is Marcia Lambeth. Artwork for the show was designed by Brenton Little. Do you have a topic you'd like us to tackle or an expert you'd like us to chat with? Send your ideas to info@mattpopovitz.com. That's info@mattpovitz.com. And if you'd like more information about Make It Simple or MPM, just head to mattpopovitz.com.